Welcome to the Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show, the Thursday edition. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by two of my colleagues, Mr. Marius Root. Marius, how are you doing this fine Thursday?
How's it, Nick? I'm well, and you?
I'm very well, thank you. And for his first appearance on the YouTube edition of the Daily Friend Show, Mr. Gabriel Krauser and his magnificent beard. Gabriel, how are you doing?
Better than my beard.
I don't know. It's looking pretty good to me.
Yeah.
not as good as my mind.
You look like a 17th century colonizer, Gabriel. The flowing locks and the big beard and stuff.
Yeah, you just need the hat.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a romantic.
Right. So let's get stuck into it. And of course, this is something that we've talked about before on the show, but this is, you get another interesting example of this kind of thing. A Centurion dad has been arrested for breaking curfew for, he says, going to buy infant formula in the middle of the night. Gauteng police have defended the arrest of a father for breaking the curfew after he allegedly went to a 24-hour pharmacy to buy milk formula for his newborn child in the early hours of last Friday morning. The man's lawyer said his client's newborn was struggling to feed, and that prompted him to go buy formula at a hospital pharmacy, as it was the only 24-hour service available. The father said that he provided police with proof of his whereabouts and proof of purchase, but the police didn't believe him. The police refused to deliver the milk formula to his kid, and he was arrested and put in prison, held in the police station for several hours. Police spokesperson Captain Masondo confirmed that he was arrested, saying he was arrested for breach of curfew under the National Disaster Management Act and taken to court. He was released on warning on the same day to appear in court on the 18th of January at the Pretoria Magistrates Court. This man is but one of 342,000 people who have been arrested under the Disaster Management Act since the beginning of the state of disaster in March of last year, which is quite a significant number of people. So, Marius, let me go to you first. What do you make of this story?
It's just the usual, overreach by the government. I mean, obviously, this guy, I mean, he can prove that he was going to go buy something for his kid. It wasn't like he was out looking for booze or trying to go jolling or something. And just like, you know, it's truly the government needs to use some of its, or like some common sense. It's exactly the same as the issue with the beaches. I think I might have mentioned it the other day. You can go to a packed mall or packed casino, but you can't go to a beach where it's sunny. I mean, vitamin D, it's a fact. It helps fight COVID and other respiratory diseases. And also beaches are generally places where you can socially distance quite easily, not like a mall or casino. And also now we've just seen with the new disaster management regulations that came out, a beach has been redefined to be something, I think anything is a beach that's within 100 meters of the sea. So it's also just this kind of petty thing just to, you know, it doesn't make any sense. Like people will, if there are silly COVID rules, people won't follow the sensible ones as well. And I mean, there's so many silly rules. I mean, I can almost understand why there was a beach ban over the festive season, but now it makes no sense whatsoever. And it's exactly the same as this guy who, I mean, you are allowed to break curfew for medical emergency. And I mean, I don't have a kid, but I know from my friends who have had babies, a screaming baby is pretty much a medical emergency. So, I mean, the guy needed to go buy some food for his kid. And also read that the police wouldn't even let him go drop it off at his house. They made his wife and the kid walk the whatever 300 meters it was to where he'd been arrested. Also, he was arrested quite close to his home, you know. And also, that also makes people lose trust in the police. The police said, okay, geez, like, guy, you're not supposed to be out, but cool, we get it. Oh, you live just there, that's fine. We better not catch you out here again. Everybody's like, fine. So, I mean, nothing like this would be in the papers. People wouldn't be thinking the cops are a bunch of morons. So, just, you know, there's just degrades faith in the police and the, you know, the rules around COVID. Well, you know, altogether.
Right, that's exactly the point. I was talking to my dad this morning, and he suggested that he thinks that there's a major crisis of legitimacy for just law and order in general that's kind of developing in the country. That you know, with tens of thousands of stupid rules, no one's going to follow anything. And I mean, South Africa is really quite a lawless place, and this is sure to, I think, create a sort of, I don't know, cultural and psychological imperative to encourage further sort of lawlessness, because people think, well, you know, these rules are stupid. Everyone who makes them is stupid, and the police can't be trusted. Gabriel, what's your take on that? What's your take on this whole issue?
Yeah, no, I agree with what you guys have been saying. I think that it's important to remember that in any society that is relatively safe and peaceful, it works because most people aren't criminals and think it's important to obey the law. And most people think that if they see someone else breaking the law, they would be doing their civic duty to report that, and they'd be manifesting a moral failure not to report that. I'm very used to sort of, you know, going around in America in the subway stations in New York, be repeated over the microphone. If you see something, say something. And one of the nightmares, if you look at sort of surveys, I'm thinking particularly of one by the Institute of Security Studies, is that the police, already long before the plague, were the least trusted institution in this country. And that's not hard to understand when you look at 500,000 people being murdered plus since 1994. So, you know, if you look at people's willingness to report crimes, it's very low. And that makes it harder for the good police to track it down. The short of this is just to say that there are lives on the line when you break trust between police and the public. And the simplest way to break trust between police and the public is to give the police a rule to enforce, which is crazy. It is crazy to have a rule interpreted anyway, which says a father cannot go and get formula for his desperately crying baby. That's just mad. It's also pretty crazy to redefine a beach to be 100 meters away. It's crazy when studies show that the one time in your life, if you're a smoker like me, that smoking has anything like a health benefit is during coronavirus season, because it reduces chances of transmission. To ban cigarettes, credit where it's due. The government's ban of New Year's Eve, basically, I think, is the one occasion in the last year where it did something dead right. Without having a hard lockdown over that period, I think many people would have been lax. And I think the deaths that we would have been seeing now would be much worse. And I think the longevity of the plague would have been worse. And so there'd be, you know, as much as it hurts those entertainers and events organizers who benefit, and tourism industry guys who benefit from the trade, would have hurt them more in the long term if we had an even more severe spike than we did. So they got one thing right, but they've got so much else wrong. And the sort of indefined time period that we're looking at extended lockdown is a problem. I think the ill-defined nature of our vaccine rollout is a big problem. And I think it's always important to ask the question, cui bono, who benefits? And the only benefit I can really see out of arresting a guy for collecting formula and 350,000 others, some of those would have been legitimate cases, but many illegitimate. The only people who benefit are narcissistic, ego trip cops who just want to prove that they have some power over you. So they're getting a little ego boost. And the real long-term benefit goes to those who want Cabral-esque class suicide, thinking in particular, of course, on Dlamini Zuma, but also the broader slate of the ANC that has spoken, including Ramaphosa, about the plague as being a kind of blessing because of the opportunities that it affords to fundamentally restructure society. And if you want to go ahead with that, you really need some militant bad behavior, which is the kind of thing this is ultimately supporting, you know, chaos, recklessness, lawlessness. It just invites further clampdowns. People get pissed off enough about this, they will start breaking serious rules, and that'll invite further police clampdown, the point that you guys made. So I think that, it's a personal interest story, very minor, kind of little one moment thing, sounds like they're all fine now. But I think it speaks, it's a great example of a deeper issue.
Mm. I think at least part of the problem here is the way that the country is essentially being governed through a sort of edict system now through the Disaster Management Act. You know, the president goes on TV and announces the new rules and they change, you know, all the time. And I think, you know, you have to sit down and watch the whole speech. And a lot of people obviously don't do that because it's boring or they don't want to, or they're doing something else at the time. And I'm sure that's contributing to some of the sort of chaos here. So, you know, I get asked all the time because, you know, I have to read the news for work and that kind of thing by friends and stuff. What are the new rules? When am I allowed to go out? Who can I do? What can I do? Morris, any take on that? Any final thoughts on this topic before we move on?
Just on the disaster management, Richard Spoor, he's quite a well-known lawyer. He put a Twitter thread up a little while ago, I think it was the last day or two. And he said that I'm not a lawyer, so I might be wrong on this, but it's unconstitutional to simply just keep extending the Disaster Management Act. At some point, you have to go to Parliament, and Parliament has to say, yes, fine, let's extend it. It's actually, you can't keep extending this thing indefinitely. And, you know, I don't know if there's any country in the world, or there probably is, but I mean, any country in the world which we look up to, sort of thing, which is would simply, you know, rule by diktat for a year. And just so these rules, I mean, a lot of them are just not made on the fly, but they're made with immediate effect. So, I mean, curfews that are announced that suddenly throws flights into chaos, you know, flights that were supposed to leave at 11 p.m., but suddenly curfews with immediate effect from 9 p.m., or, you know, people who sell booze or whatever, you know, they've already got their stock for the week, but now suddenly alcohol, you can't sell alcohol with immediate effect, and there's probably trucks on the road bringing alcohol to where it needs to go and whatever the case is. So it just shows that, shows you that the government doesn't consider business or citizens as partners, considers them as, you know, subjects. People just have to listen to what they say, and there's no kind of, and also, I mean, I think a big, a symptom of this is the fact that Cyril Ramaphosa has not taken questions off the cuff once since the whole thing started. And you know what? I'm not the biggest fan of Donald Trump, but just for one thing you can say about that guy, he fronted up to hostile media almost weekly. And the Ramaphosa, where the media in South Africa is far more friendly to Ramaphosa than the American media was to Donald Trump, the Cyril Ramaphosa hasn't done that once. And that, you know, that says a lot, I think, about how the government considers the people that live in this country.
Exactly, exactly. Anyway, let's move on to another COVID story. And this is one of the most important developments probably in COVID itself and the story around the disease itself for a long time. So forgive me if I get this a little bit muddled because it's all a little bit technical medical. Gabriel will be able to light the way through this, but let me introduce it by saying that so I'm sure many people have been aware that scientists have identified that there is a significant mutation, a noteworthy mutation in that's occurred in South Africa. And actually most of the COVID cases we have now appear to be consisting of that mutation. And one of the things that scientists are worried about in the mutation is something called E484K, which is like a mutation which they call an escape mutation, which they believe might possibly allow the virus to escape some of the antibodies that people produce when they get sick with COVID. So this has significant consequences because it means that it could firstly allow people to get possibly reinfected who've already had COVID, and also it may reduce the effectiveness of vaccines. Gabriel, how seriously should we be taking this, and how likely is it that this is going to be a big problem?
Thanks, Nick. So yeah, just to kind of give people a bit of a sense of what E484K means, the virus has, let's just call them locations. Let's say 1,200 locations. Each location is like a page where you can find stuff written down for how the virus should replicate and behave. And 501 was a very important location, which is discussed a lot because it is cardinal to the British strain and the South African strain. And what happened at 501 is you went from a 501N to a 501Y. So the meaningful genomic text that was there for how it should reproduce had altered. Now, this was called a host mutation or a host adaptation, which basically means that what the virus had done after getting into human beings is, you know, it's constantly making typographical errors, just typos. And most of them are meaningless, but every now and then it strikes on a typo that makes a meaningful change that has a bad effect for the virus. Most mutations end up being bad for the virus. But finally, it found one that was really good for the virus. It increased its ability to bind on ACE2 receptors, which means it can replicate faster, which means you need a lower viral load in order to get symptomatic, which means there's going to be more viral shedding. And it's from that that you get basically the sort of headline result that the E501Y mutation increases transmissibility by around 50%. A host mutation is different to an escape mutation. An escape mutation is where it figures out it's being attacked and it's going to dodge the attack. And the way to figure out whether something is an escape mutation, whether to suspect whether something is an escape mutation from the start, is to look at the typos that are happening at the same location and see, are you going from one version to another version? Like it was always an N, now it's always a Y. If that's the case, it's a host mutation. But if it's going from one location in multiple directions, many different kinds of meaningful or multiple meaningful mutations are happening at the same location, then it's saying, look, this is a weak spot where our body's grabbing onto it at that location, and it's just trying to get away from that form of itself so that it's harder for our body to bind. So that's the sort of hallmark of an escape mutation. 484 exhibits this property, and this is not news. One of the very frustrating things about this is we knew this since last year. Jesse Bloom, the world's leading virologist in this regard, published a paper on the 31st of December identifying 484K as being the worst possible escape mutation that they could generate artificially in a laboratory. And its receptor binding, what it does is indubitably reduce your antibody's ability to attack the virus. What we don't know is how far a role that plays in human bodies, because there's differences between the test tube and the human bodies. One of them being that in the human body, there are more than one kinds of things attacking it. You don't just have antibodies, you also have T cells, B cells, and so on. So we don't really know fully what the impact will be. Professor Willem Hanekom is in charge of the consortium, the South African consortium, which is investigating this mutant strain. And he said to me last week that we should expect early this week the results of their clinical trials to be published. I reached out to him 2 days ago. He said that it looked like the trials had been completed, but the results have not been published. We're waiting for those results to be published. The delay is going from very understandable to potentially concerning if it lasts any longer, but right now it's just very understandable. They've got to double check their numbers. But to make one last thing clear, E484 is not the only location that's mutating. So I spoke to Professor Darren Martin at UCT, who's an evolutionary viral biologist, and he said, and referenced me the literature, and I gave it a read, that if you look at the cardinal mutations, if you look at the top 10 mutations in the South African strain, we've got 501, we've got 484, you look at the top 10, three of those are host mutations, seven of them are escape mutations on the basis of this sort of genomic understanding of the escape mutation's hallmark being a multidirectional mutation versus a host mutation being a unidirectional mutation. So we've got a lot of reason to worry. Darren Martin, Professor Darren Martin said to me, you can expect the vaccines at this stage to be 20 to 30% less effective on the South African mutant overall, because the mutations can also work together. Now that means if the vaccine was going to be 70% effective, you times that by 20% less, you don't just minus it. So that comes down to about 56% effective. That's still very useful. You inoculate the population. If you inoculated the whole population with a vaccine that's 50% effective, that would bring down the R effective, the reproductive rate, by half. And if our reproductive rate right now is sitting at 1.4, that's my estimate, and it's in concord with six South African professors that I spoke to, it comes down to 0.7. And at 0.7, that means the virus is shrinking its share of the population. So this is not an argument against taking the vaccine, but it is a huge argument against vaccine companies that they have not been more proactive in investigating this. And the even bigger frustration is that I have now spoken to, I've asked this question to now one dozen medical experts in the country and globally in Switzerland, America, the UK, and South Africa. I've said everyone has a number in mind for the protection level that is offered by vaccine, 70% for this one, 90% for that one, 95% for the other one. What level of protection is offered by the immune system? There's no number. There's no study to provide a number. There's much more evidence available. And the evidence strongly suggests that it's 99.9%. And in fact, it could be 99.9999% if you look at the dearth of reinfections that have been confirmed by the same strain and the number of reinfections that have been confirmed, pretty much all being from mutant strains. And this just matters when you think about vaccine rollout prioritization. I think that people need to start thinking very seriously about if they've had COVID-19 and they know that for sure, whether it is a moral duty not to be vaccinated until others have been vaccinated, because you already are very protected. Statistically, you've got a very strong protection and the next guy has nothing. And right now a vaccine rollout program looks like it's going to target people that have already been infected, making the least possible difference per vaccine dose, which will give more time to the virus to spread amongst COVID naives, is the technical term. I call them COVID virgins, people who've never had COVID. And the more time it has to do that, the more time it has to evolve. And the more chance it has to evolve in a way that really does undermine the vaccine, really does undermine antecedent immunity, and most obviously, the more time it has to kill. So this is a very serious issue. Once you start thinking about the mutation, I'll just say one last thing. Professor Darren Martin said from the beginning, the biggest messaging mismanagement around the world was this idea that you need to flatten the curve in time for the vaccine to come along. And then the vaccine will just make it all go away. He was like, you need to flatten the curve so that this thing doesn't get a chance to evolve, to outcompete both our natural immune response and the vaccine. And that's how it works in the wild. The cardinal SARS-CoV-2, lineage A, the original kind of Doritos flavor, is 229E. And that's been isolated since the 50s or the 60s, and there's studies going back to the 80s looking at how long it takes to mutate. And every couple of years, it mutates to the point where a lot of people that have been infected with the original version are now basically completely unprotected from the new version. And that's because it just can play around the whole population, so it gets the maximum number of chances to evolve. If we let that happen to this, which is significantly more deadly than the flu, then 2021 is going to be a very hard year, and there will continue to be very hard years going forward. We must be very serious about putting this thing to bed. That means taking vaccines very seriously, even if they're only 50% effective, even if they're only 60% effective rather than 80 or 90. And it also means that we need to think very seriously about the most efficient way to vaccinate. There'll be more on this coming forward. We look forward to Hanocom's results. We look forward to discovery. After 2 weeks, they still haven't told us what their new estimate is for the number of people that have been infected in South Africa. They said 13 million in August 2020. So what do they think it is today? 32 million? If it's 32 million and you are vaccinating people who've already been infected, you're making no difference, then our vaccines are going to be in big trouble. But we need more facts, and we'll let you know as soon as they come.
No, definitely. And Gabriel and I are probably, I think we're going to record tomorrow a show about this for our podcast, Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree. Anyway, Maurice, any final thoughts on this before we move on? It sounds a lot like, that was quite a science-heavy thing that Gabriel just went into, but it sounds a lot like the government's failure to organize proper vaccine rollout really seems like it's going to be a much bigger deal than even originally thought. What's your take, Maurice?
Well, I have to say, trying to say anything about the virus after Gabriel's talking is like reading Leon Schuster's joke book after reading George Orwell or Ernest Hemingway or something. there's too much to add. I just think it's obviously important. We need to get the vaccine as quickly as possible to get us back to normal. And I mean, the rest of the world's going to, well, not the rest of the world, but a lot of the world's going to leave us behind if we don't get enough people vaccinated, because we're going to be keep going into lockdowns and whatever, you and, you know, stalling the economy, which is not good for anybody. And also it's worse for poor people.
Right. And it's also worth noting that our tourism sector is going to be punished for a very long time because of our mutant strain. A lot of countries are actually closing their borders to us, basically.
But that's almost like we're a victim of our own success in a way, because we, especially for an African country, we've got quite good, viral sequencing labs and so on. We're probably one of the only places in Africa that could actually identify a new kind of virus strain. So, I mean, there's no guarantee that this thing is actually from South Africa, being from anywhere. But we were the people who identified it. So now it's called the, South African variant. Probably the same as the UK. The variant they got there is because they're the first people to identify it. It's not necessarily originally from the UK, whatever you, and I mean, if that kind of strain emerged in the Central African Republic, I mean, no, I don't want to cast aspersions on our Central African colleagues, but I doubt they got the kind of technology know-how there to kind of sequence a new viral strain. So I do think it's kind of being a victim of your own, not success, but having a victim of your own infrastructure almost.
Mm. All right. Well, let us move on from COVID because we've spent now, I guess, basically the first whole part of the show talking about it. And we're just going to very quickly for the last sort of 4 minutes or so, just talk about something else quite interesting that's going on in the world. And this is, of course, the U.S. House of Representatives has voted to impeach Trump for a second time. That makes him the first president in United States history to be impeached twice. This means that it will now go to the Senate, which is the other house of the American Congress, where they will have a trial to determine whether he should be officially impeached or acquitted. If he is impeached, he will not be able to run again for any office in the United States. So he won't be able to be a governor, president, senator, anything. The vote in the House was 232 in favor of impeaching Trump, 297 against impeaching him. However, the Senate majority leader, or former majority leader, Mitch McConnell, who's coming to the end of his term now because the Democrats have taken back the Senate, rejected calls to hold the impeachment trial before Biden's inauguration, saying that there won't be time to do it fairly and that it should be done once Trump has left office. Anyway, let me move on to say, Gabriel, it seems a bit weird to impeach someone after they've left office. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so we discussed this for an hour on our last two Crickets in a Thorn Tree podcast. My reading is that constitutionally that is permitted, that the founding fathers had it in mind, that one of the punishments of impeachment trial by the Senate is that you get removed from office, but that a separate thing is not being able to run again. And so that would be the practical reason to do it. To my mind, there's no legal argument for incitement. What Trump said, I just don't see any legal standard by which you could put him in jail for incitement. I have seen that discussed a lot on CNN. But I do believe that there's a political argument. And a lot of Republicans agree. I think it's an impeachable offense. Impeachment is precisely supposed to not be a legal standard. It's supposed to be a political standard. The problem is this. And you can see it in the headline. He's being impeached again. So the Ukraine gate impeachment, to my mind, was ridiculous. I'm not saying what Trump did was fabulous, but it was not an impeachable offense. If you held that standard going backwards, you'd have to impeach every American president for the last 100 years. And if you held that standard going forwards, you will force American presidents to not be able to conduct diplomacy. So the Democrats impeached incorrectly once, and that came after trying to impeach him on the basis of being Putin's puppet, which was complete fabricated lies, fake news. So the Democrats have made their name khatas, as some may say, and now they're trying to clean their act by doing this. Don't know if it's good. So politically, I don't know what the right way forward is. I do believe that it's an impeachable offense, and I think if the Republicans take advantage of this, as Mitch McConnell has supposedly intimated, as a way to pair Trump off from the party going forward, maybe that'd be good.
we'll see what comes of that. It's probably going to continue to be quite a dramatic story. Morris, any final thoughts in the last 20 seconds or so before we wrap up?
I suppose the only reason to impeach Trump is to make sure he doesn't run in 2024. But I mean, I don't know if that's likely. I mean, we know Americans don't like a loser, and Trump is always telling us how much of a loser he's not. So I don't know if he'd be, you know, who knows what will still happen in the next couple of years. And he's, I mean, getting the nomination in 2016 was kind of a, nobody expected that. So maybe anything could happen in 2024 still. But even if he doesn't get impeached, I'd find it very unlikely that he could win the nomination in 2024 again. But who knows, stranger things have happened. I didn't think he'd win the election. I didn't think Brexit would happen. So I'm wrong often on these things.
Gabriel and I did a long discussion about this, as he mentioned, on our podcast, Two Crickets on a Thorn Tree, which you can find on the dailyfriend.co.za, along with other great articles and news pieces and all that good stuff. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today, and this is the last episode of this week. We will be back on Monday. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the IRR, please go to irr.org.za, click the Join Us button, and sign up to become a friend of the Institute, giving us a monthly donation of less than 100 rand to keep supporting the work we do, the media we produce, and the alternative views we create. Thanks very much for listening, and have a great weekend, everyone.